Hello, my name is Simon Southall. I'm the presenter of Wild Disabled, and I'm here in Devon with the fabulous Michael Keynes.
Hey there, Simon.
Nothing about me. How are you?
Great, thank you. Excellent. Good to see you here.
Yeah, thank you very much. I made it eventually.
Yeah, right.
Little story to tell the audience is we arrived last night, and it was the 31st of January. This will be going out about the end of March, but for last night, it was the Beast from the East or whatever it was. So we set off from Leicester to come and interview you about 3:30. We arrived at your hotel at 10:30, and you kindly gave us accommodation.
Yeah.
Because we weren't going to be staying here.
No, that's right. We heard your plight, literally, trying to get Torquay, so you abandoned that idea, because obviously you wouldn't have been able to get over. No. So, yeah, we put you in one of our amazing rooms, which is fully...
Magpie Suite.
Yeah, which is beautifully set out for people with disabilities, and also enabling you to enjoy that wonderful luxury, and yet at the same time feel like you're in an amazing room.
It is, and the best thing about it is the actual room doesn't feel disabled. It doesn't feel adapted.
No.
Or you've got a walk-in shower, you can get around in a wheelchair. Bit difficult with a scooter, but my scooter's quite large.
Yeah.
But you can get into the toilet, it's got handrails in there, and you can get around most of the hotel as well. It's really nice friendly. You've got a wheelchair in the disabled toilet on the first floor, and I've had no trouble getting around the actual hotel, which has been fantastic. You can drop your car off at the front, and the staff will go and drive it to the car park for you.
Perfect.
You know, how brilliant is that?
That's what it's all about. It's great service.
It's the
Limpstone Manor.
Limpstone Manor, and it has the most spectacular views of Devon.
Incredible, isn't it?
It is. I mean, we've got white top mountains at the moment.
Yeah, the snow is, you know, we're looking out over the Bay of Lyme, Exmouth over there, and then beyond that we've got, you know, Brixham. They've got people kite surfing at this.
It's minus three outside, and people
kite surfing.
It.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous, isn't it?
I know. Gosh.
And you've got your fantastic vineyard out there.
Perfect.
I want a free bottle of champagne.
Well, you'd have to come back for that. In 4 years.
In 4 years. How long is it going to take?
Yeah, actually five. Yeah, five.
Wow.
Two more years of growing, and then we'll get the grapes, and then 3 years after we'll have the wine.
So, is that going to be like £200-300 a bottle or more?
Well, it won't start that expensive, but with ageing and in time, if it's a good wine, it can be as much as that. So, But, we're doing English sparkling wine.
Okay. Now, I do a lot of research for when I do interviews. There's one question I got really want to ask you. Now, my wife told me not to ask you it.
Okay.
Okay.
Now, so, you know you've got to ask it.
I've got to ask it. So, when you type in Michael Keynes in Google, when you do celebrity appearances, are people disappointed that you're not the Michael Keynes from Batman?
Yeah, not a lot of people know that, but I'm not the actor, I'm of course the chef, but at the same time, I wonder now how many people who type in Michael Caine as the chef and get the actor and are disappointed that way, you know? It's ironic, but actually that namesake, you know, the only difference being that the mine's got an S and he doesn't, but it's been a quite
and the hundreds of millions of pounds of bank in the Oscar.
Totally, which I'm working on, but but you know, it's not a bad comparison, and it's quite funny really.
Mm. Now, you have one arm. So, 1994, it was an August bank holiday weekend. You were driving somewhere, and I understand you fell asleep at the wheel.
I did, fell asleep at the wheel. Nodded off.
Yeah.
The car drifted to the left-hand side, hit a barrier, and then went on a head-on collision into the central barrier. The car hit and rolled. As it rolled, it took off my arm. And it almost like, somebody witnessed said that it was almost like roller-coasted down the central reservation and then jumped off. Fortunately, back onto the right side of the road where it remained upside down. So I woke up on impact. I was hanging upside down, you know, obviously braced in by my seatbelt. And then I noticed this hand was on the floor. And I looked over and I realised it was my hand and saw all of the loss and obviously the blood that was coming out. And then, you know, obviously I had to release myself from the harness, if you like, and get out of the car, which I did. And all I wanted to do was run away from the scene because I couldn't believe it, this has just happened to me. But obviously a lot of people approached me and calmed me down and got me through at what was a very difficult moment.
Yeah. Put it brilliantly, that must have shit you up completely.
Oh, it's a massive trauma accident.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, I was 25 years old. I thought that I was invincible. I was in a dexterous work, which is being a chef. It's all about using both of your hands. I was right-handed. I lost my right arm. I just wanted to give up, you know. I was there like, you know, this is it. I mean, there's nothing worth living for. And I said, just wanted to fade away. But, you know, so I was fighting for my life, you know.
Yeah.
Thought my career was over. And, you know, and that was a difficult thing to deal with there and then. And then obviously got to hospital. You know, the people were helping me on the day, and somebody particularly, you know, made me focus on the bigger picture, family, loved ones. And then when you get to hospital, they put you under anaesthetic. You know immediately you've lost your arm. It's damaged limitations, saved your life. And then you wake up, you see your parents, and you say, you know, straight away, I said, look, I've lost my arm, but this isn't going to beat me. It's not going to define me. I want to carry on if I can and get straight back in
What's incredible about the story as well, not a lot of people know this, is you returned to work after losing your arm about 2 weeks afterwards.
I did, part-time, yeah, I did.
And I mean, that's just nuts.
I know, full-time is 4 weeks. Well, other than the loss of arm, I was just a walking wounded. I mean, nothing else. Fortunately, no neck injury. There were no superficial cuts or bruises on me. And so I was able to, you know, go back to work. In fact, I remember going to see a surgeon in Exeter. And I said, you know, he looked at me and said, well, come back, we'll get the stitches out. I said, well, what can I do? He said, we go back to work and do what you want. And so I thought, well, I'd rather get straight there. That whole expression, like, get back in the deep end, you know, learn to swim. He said, you know, or something happens, you get back in the car, back on the horse. And I just thought, well, I've got to try, you know, I've got to, you know, give it a go. And I remember being at home within the week of, I was in the hospital for a week, 6 days, you know, got taken home by my parents. It was a very emotional journey home, very emotional going home. My life had changed. It was difficult to come to terms with. And in that week, my father put on an art easel and he put it up, you know, with the view from the house, which overlooked Exeter. And I thought, well, what's the point? You know, I lost my arm, you know, I lost my right arm. And but very, very, very slowly, I thought, well, I'll have a go, you know, I'll have a go with my left hand. And then as I started to draw and paint, I realised that the eye to hand contact, that ability was still there. That, you know, that
it's a learning process.
It is. And I knew that I just need to give myself time. But I could see the detail was there and the talent was still there. And that was a really good lesson to learn. And I just thought, well, everything's intellectually still there. I just need to now adapt to become left handed, obviously. Mm. And cope. And, you know, obviously found out about, you know, false arms and obviously prosthetics. I went to America, looked at robotic arms, and, you know, but you also realise that, you know, to replace the hand and the arm, you know, such a high amputation, it would be very difficult. So then you just got to learn to live with what you've got.
Yeah.
Even though I didn't have a prosthetic arm after 2 weeks, what it enabled me to do is get back in into a zone or an area that I was comfortable and that I could then quickly learn and see how I could adapt into the environment. Because if I felt that process of adaptation wasn't forthcoming and I felt that I couldn't do the job, then I would have known that I've been giving it a go, you know, I'll move on. But, you know, there was no insurance payout, unfortunately. It was, and I thought, well, I won't sit around feeling sorry for myself. I'll get involved and I'll see what I can do and I'll be determined to give it a best shot.
You've done all right for yourself, haven't you?
Yeah, it's been hard work, but it would have been hard work anyway. But I've done all right, but I've persevered. I've not let the loss of my arm define me as a disabled person. And as you said to me, Simon, when you came to see me, you said you hadn't even realised.
I was just saying that before the interview. I've seen you on TV a number of times and I had no idea you had one arm.
Yeah.
It's just you don't notice it.
Yeah.
It's not that you don't go out your way for it, do you? You don't go looking for a person with one arm, do you?
No. Which is really interesting. And that's why I feel comfortable wearing the prosthetic, because you don't draw, you know, your attention to the fact that if you're in a wheelchair or you've got a white stick or, you know, you've got crutches or you've got no arm, people are immediately drawn to that. Whereas, you know, when I wear the prosthetic arm, I kind of blend in a lot easier. But, you know, when people go to shake my hand, it's like, oh, what's the matter with your arm, mate? Well, I lost it in a car accident. Like, oh, really sorry. I'm like, well, don't worry, it wasn't your fault, you know.
I was interviewing Nicholas McCarthy a couple of weeks ago, and he's a classical piano player, and he's only got one arm.
Yeah.
And it's just fantastic, because obviously people go shake his hand, he's not there.
Yeah. But you can just see them, you know, awkward. Yeah. But, you know, you have to, we're laughing about our fact that we have disabilities, but we have humour, we have still talent, we have so much more than that defines us as a person than the loss of our ability.
You kind of have to laugh at your disability as well, because I lost my legs when I was 4 years ago, so I can't really walk. And I get called legless when I go, you know, if I get a drink or something, or, you know, if you go out and say, hey, Wheels, slow down, and, you know, you take it with a light-hearted, and I was just saying, if you like, give me five.
Exactly.
And you just called your, what you call, you said about your drink.
My little nick, well, my nickname's called, I call my nickname myself, as you do, Mickey Five Fingers, you know. And, yeah, and then you've got to call it the Mickey Five Fingers cocktail, and you make it yours, or you...
You own it.
You own it, because, you know what, actually, it is yours, and actually, you know, you making light of it makes people more relaxed around you, but also, you know, it's understanding that you feel comfortable and confident in knowing that, you know, you are in control of it, rather than people taking control of the circumstances and making you feel, you know, embarrassed or difficult. Why should we feel bad about something that makes us at times feel bad, you know? So we got to make light of it.
Right, let's start off with your career then. Let's start chefing. Now, I've done some research. You were a teacher's pet.
Wow.
Okay, student of the year, 1987.
Okay, yeah. But 86 was not a good year. So
why was 86? 86 was a great year for music. It wasn't. But no, go on. Why was 86 a bad year, and why was 87 such a good year?
Well, I left school with a school report that said could do better, so that's fair enough. So I went to college in 86, and what happened there was that I nearly got kicked out of college, so... Mm-hmm. I had this sort of tendency of being over-exuberant and slightly distracted. So after that, I realised I needed to knuckle down, came back the next year, and I got Student of the Year. So it was a turning point, really. You know, I nearly got kicked out of college, and then I thought, you know, all this ridiculous behaviour and lack of concentration is masking a great ability, and I wanted to just come back and get focused. And really, that was the difference, really. I suddenly realised that I was only hurting my own prospects. And so I came back and got focused, and as you say, won Student of the Year.
Yeah, cool, and well done.
Thank you.
Excellent. So, I'm not a posh chap, okay? I mean, I stay at night, Hilton's and stuff and whatever when I go out and do when I do videos and when I do recordings. And this is a nice hotel, and it's nice without being snobby. I think that's the best way to put it. And it's a nice, relaxed atmosphere. It's very comfortable, and. I'm one of the blokes where you come to a Michelin star hotel, and like for lunch today, I had a tuna sandwich and some chips. Mm. Okay, because I don't do fancy food.
Well, you wanted the chips, was it?
It was me. And they come like stacked in a little, in a little square
thing.
Absolutely, you know, you can see a chef just chopping them down in the kitchen. Now, I know nothing about cooking, really. Okay, I've been aside from like cooking Slimming Worlds because I'm so fat, it's unbelievable.
Well, you like your food.
My food. I do. Yeah. So everyone, you've got an MBE, member of the British Empire, and everyone knows what you get it for cooking.
Service for hospitality.
Yes, absolutely. Okay, and everyone knows what an MBE is. From what I've talked about people with is they understand what a Michelin star is. That you're very highbrow and it's a very posh restaurant. The food's quite good. But what do you actually have to do to get a Michelin star? Because you've got two of them, and that's just showing off.
Yeah, well, I had two for 18 years, and then I left that particular property, came here, and within 6 months we got one star. So I think that really it's important to put the context of a Michelin star. So if you have two, you're in the top 10% within the Europe and the world in terms of rating of restaurant. So if you've got one star, you're in the top 15%. And I think the important thing is that there are... You know, you're part of an elite, talented bunch of individuals who are working in a very competitive industry, who are always being judged now through social media or in the guidebooks on a daily, yearly basis. And you're not judged because of anything other than your talent and ability to cook great food. So, you know, it's like, you know, you're in the top, it's like being in the Premiership and being in the best team. You know, you're up against with the best of the best, and you're cooking at the highest level, and you get rewarded for that every year with the losing or gaining a Michelin star. And so, you know, to get two was amazing, to keep it for 18 years, incredible. But I left all that behind to start a new venture, Limpston Manor, and, you know, within 6 months of opening, we had one star, and we've not even been open 2 years. So when this goes out, we'll be approaching our 2-year birthday. So 2 years in April. So, you know, from the listeners' perspective, you know, they're talking about Michelin stars. What's that mean? It means that there's only 3 you can get, 1, 2, and 3.
Yeah.
There's only 4 people in the UK or 5 people in restaurants in the UK that have got 3 stars. So it kind of puts it into context. You are part of the elite, culinary elite.
And that's why my chips look so fabulous.
Because it's all about presentation. It's all about, you know, and the thing is, we're a hotel. So we're a hotel restaurant. So, you know, we have 21 bedrooms. So if somebody stays the night before, you know, they don't want to get up and have a Michelin star lunch and a Michelin star dinner. They, as you say, you want a sandwich, something simple. And as a hotel, you need to provide that.
Mm. Coming back to your MBE for a second,
yes.
I have to ask this. Who presented your MBE to you?
It was Prince Charles.
Oh, that's the one you want, isn't it?
Yeah.
You want Harry, William, Charles, you know. Yeah, you want the future king. Because you don't want Anne.
No.
Or Andrew, do you? You want someone in the line, don't you?
You do. It's a very proud moment, you know.
Yeah.
So, very, very, very proud. And you know, I got to say that, you know, Michelin star's great, MBE was amazing. Chef of the Year. I've won many gongs and many awards.
Yeah.
But they all represent a particular time in my career and progress in my life. And I think, you know, you look back, you know, it's just nice to be recognised. But more importantly, for your contribution for the industry and also what you do within the community.
Mm. You also cooked at number 10.
I did, yeah.
Yeah, which Prime Minister was that for?
So it was Tony Blair and the Prime Minister of Poland at the time. It was Mr Blair's birthday.
Okay.
And I was asked to go and cook. And I have to say, it was an incredible experience. It's one of the fastest services I've ever done.
How fast? Then,
well, it was just literally, you know, right, send the main course, we send the starter, right, main course is away. I'm like, ah, well, I haven't cooked it yet. You know, it's unbelievably quick. But it was very exciting. You know, number 10's kitchen is was a challenging space, but it was, you know, well-used and well-versed to serving, you know, dinners. And what an amazing honour. You know, okay, irrespective of your political background, you know, I've been to Buckingham Palace, I've been to Downing Street, I've been, you know, we've been asked to, you know, on several occasions to do various amazing things. And irrespective, you just think, wow, what an incredible opportunity.
Mm. What did you cook in?
Well, we started off with a treat of duck liver with beetroot, south beetroot and turnips. And then we did a lovely turbot beautiful turbot dish with and then the dessert, he had chocolate tart, so yeah, good.
Mm, okay. Raymond Blanc's had a lot to do with your career.
Mm-hmm.
How many times has he shouted at you in the kitchen?
Well, I worked for Raymond for 3 years, and like any high pressured environment, of which, you know, cooking and kitchens can be, there were occasions where, you know, I was shouted at, but not many, to be fair.
No?
No, not really. Raymond's not a very shouty chef, if I'm honest. He's very passionate, and he's, you know, when I have seen him lose it a couple of times, but it's not an everyday, you know, it was never a kitchen where you went in and were worried about the next time the saucepan was going to come across the kitchen, or when's he going to come and give you a roasting. He wasn't like that, but he's very good at mentoring and nurturing you. So, but he gave you a lot of trust. But if you abuse that trust, then you would get you'd know about it. You get a roasting, literally a culinary term, roasting.
A roasting.
Yeah.
Stick you in the oven and cook you. Okay. So I would say you can probably pick up the phone to any chef in the country who is well known, who's on TV, because you're mates, you all do BBC Good Food shows together or whatever, and I'm guessing you all go for a pint or whatever, and you know each other reasonably well.
Yeah.
Yeah? Okay. Who is the one chef in the country you would not open a restaurant with? I just want to point out to the listeners there, Michael just went, oh my God, and just put his head to the floor and went, I don't want to answer that.
The best way to answer that is, I wonder who would want to open a restaurant with me. I think the good thing about chefs is that we're quite independent, so we are independently good at what we do, and we're different for it, so, you know, but I don't think it wouldn't be fair to single anyone out, but I think that what I've learned over time is that you know, there comes a point in anybody's career where people need to do something for themselves, and what you find is, even if you start somebody's career, so I've now had lots of chefs come and work for me, and now doing their own thing and being successful, and what you've realised is actually you can help people go forward, but it's best that these, you know, popular chefs I left to manage their own opportunities, because otherwise you end up falling out, you know, over silly things. You know, chefs are, you know, with volatile characters, with sensitive souls, and so I'd rather keep the friendship away from the business.
Okay, wink, wink.
So none of them.
Okay, now, changing the subject slightly differently.
Yes.
You also are a patron of the Family for Children's Trust.
Yes, charity, yeah, for adopted children.
Absolutely, because I understand you're adopted as well.
I was, Simon. I was adopted at 6 weeks old and grew up in a loving family. I was the youngest of six children. And, you know, and I want to just promote the fact that adoption really works, that it's a very good tool to deal with some of the social issues within children in care, but also it's a good way of giving children a secure and loving environment to grow up in, which is what I had.
I mean, if anyone's interested in listening to actually doing adoption as well, the best thing to do is contact your local county council and they will talk you through the process. There are agencies who you can go to as well, but obviously for adoption process, first point of call is probably the council and they'll talk you through the whole process.
That's right, Simon. Thank you.
Cool. Right, quick fire questions.
Yes.
Right, these are fun. Some of these might get into trouble. Some of them might not. We'll see how we go.
Not for the first time.
Okay. First of all, favourite chef. And you can't say yourself.
No, okay, favourite chef. Ooh, okay. Most respected chef for me, mentor-wise, Raymond Bloch.
Yeah, I thought that. Yeah. Worst chef.
Well, you know, it was a guy I worked with when I was younger, and he was such a cowboy. And let's just say he was called Paul.
Okay. Favourite dish?
Favourite dish? Well, seasonal, this time of year, you know, I guess on the moment, you know, scallops are fantastic. So my favourite dish, actually, I'll answer that differently. The type of food I like to cook when I'm at home is I like lovely, you know, I love Asian food. So, and I like to do things that I don't normally cook myself. So my comfort food dish would be something like a chicken tikka masala curry or wonderful platter of shellfish. Or something as simple as a stir fry or
things. Can I come around your house for dinner?
Yeah, but then I love roast chicken, you know, like, you know, roast beef, just simple. But when I cook, and I, you know, it's nice to do, you know, that's when I kind of I like cooking, you know, and I like, you know, being creative. You take a different approach to it, but, you know, you can't cook. It's like if you're a sportsman, you can't run at 100 miles all the time. You've got to take that time to chill out and actually do things which allow you to relax and get away and recover. And food's similar if you're detailed and all the time. Mm. There you go.
Okay. Do you ever eat takeaway?
Yes, I definitely do. because it feels like a guilty pleasure and a night off.
Cool. Excellent. Can I stay for dinner for free?
No.
Okay, we'll move on. Favourite hairy biker?
Dave.
Dave. Cool. Favourite cooking show?
Good one. Okay, I'm going to go retro. Ready Steady.
Wow, that's an old one, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah, Ainsley Harriott.
I said, I'll tell you why I like it. I'll tell you why. It's because when it was on, I thought it was really, really silly. But actually, the reason why I chose that as a retro one is because it was one of the longest series, running series, and also a lot of the chefs on there have done, you know, have gone on and become sort of legends. But Ready Steady Cook. But actually, my favourite current show would be, you know, I love Rick Stein programme. That's great too. Mm.
Worst cooking show? The one when you watch your TV and you're thinking, oh, I really want to watch that cooking show. You come across one, you think, oh, that's awful. I don't really want to watch that one.
Gosh, well, that's a good point. Worst cooking show, I don't know. Car crash TV for cooking is always difficult.
Man versus food or something.
Yeah, I tell you, even though I think it's really funny, you know, Come Dine With Me is sort of like, it's not great food. It's the worst, you know, but it's really good entertainment.
It's people who can't cook who think they can cook, and then they serve it to people who think they are excellent in tasting food and really not good in tasting food at all.
So that's cringeworthy, though.
It is. Yeah, I can't.
Let's say that.
Yeah.
Then.
Okay. Cool.
We agree.
Yeah. Do you ever have an occasion where you think, I just don't want to cook, I'm going to have a bacon sandwich?
Yeah. Or I have a takeaway. You know, a butty or. Or, you know, actually, you know, I go to the drive-thru and get a burger. I mean, sometimes you just think, I've got the kids, I've got dinner, life is busy. Yeah, definitely.
Mm. MasterChef.
Yes.
Greg or John?
Greg.
Greg? Is he more fun?
Yeah, he tells better jokes.
Oh, okay. I was covering the BBC Good Food Show, and John was on stage, and I swear he was pissed. And it was absolutely hilarious. He goes, right, I'm going to the Caribbean in a few minutes. Hooray!
Both are funny, both are good, and I've got a great relationship with both. But Greg, when you get him going on jokes, he is just fantastic.
Quickest dish you eat when you're hungry?
Porridge.
Oh, that's cool. Oh, okay, cool. Okay, best job you've had?
The one I'm doing now.
Really? Yeah.
Limestone Manor. Being the owner of Limestone Manor.
It's a nice hotel.
But it doesn't feel like a job. Yeah. It's what I've created.
Because you come into work, you think, it's nice being here. It's just it's nice, great. Relaxing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's a nice place to work. That's right. Beautiful place.
10 things not to say to a person with one arm.
Okay.
Okay?
Yeah.
Does it take you twice as long to do things because you've got one arm? Have you ever had that said to you?
Yeah, my answer to that is actually it takes half the time.
Yeah, because people think, it happens to a lot of people. They think you've only got one arm, it's going to take you twice as long.
Yeah, well, you could say that.
You get extra time on exams and things, exactly. And you know, it's, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm looking at your prosthetic. Yeah, okay. And it is kind of blending to your skin.
Yes, but actually the gloves a bit naff, I've got to get new gloves.
Can you do that choppy thing still with you?
Yeah, definitely. But I don't have to worry about cutting my fingers, though.
Well, that's what I'm wondering. Have you chopped so fast you've actually caught the knife in your prosthetic?
Yeah, I have. Have you? Yeah. But in the early days, I used to have to put a guard on there, clip it on, because, you know, I used to, you know.
Because I worked in a kitchen for a very short time. I mean, I was awful. I mean, I was really bad in the kitchen. And this is going back 20 years. We got like a sack of potatoes and a sack of carrots, and you had to chop them. Within 2 or 3 days, you got a little bit faster, but not good. Yeah. But the amount of blood and blue plasters you went through was enormous.
Yeah, I don't have to worry about any of that anymore, do I? So it's good.
You don't have to worry about blue plasters.
No. Actually, you know what? It's really funny because I did a Saturday Kitchen once. And I put plaster on my finger and my prosthetic, and everybody was calling in saying, why has he got a plaster on his prosthetic finger? But what happened is, let's just cut the glove. So I put a plaster on it, and I thought, I bet it's like a Keith Lemon thing. Why does he always wear a bandage on his arm? It'd be like my little call-in thing. It was really, it was hilarious.
Has someone ever asked you to give you a hand and then you've handed over your hand?
Yeah, I've done that. I have done that as a joke, actually. Give us a hand, mate, and you kind of...
So you don't start clapping, you just go, here you are.
Exactly.
Has anyone ever said to you, I would die if I only had one arm?
No, but they always say, I'll give an arm and a leg. And I'd say, no, you wouldn't. You bloody wouldn't, believe me.
People say to my, because I've got my scooter here.
Yeah.
I'm always in my scooter, and people say, oh, I'd love to have the go on that. And I go, excellent, where do you want me to go?
How
am I going to get around? It's ridiculous. Does anyone ever come back up to you and say, you're so brave?
In a way, yes, they do. I can understand, they say, and it's not patronising at all, but they say you're an inspiration and you're
that was the next one, actually. You're such an inspiration.
Yeah, that happens a lot.
Absolutely.
You know, the bravery is seen in different ways, you know. It's not the act of bravery, it's the courage of bravery.
Mm. Do people ask you how you dress yourself?
Not really, but I would say the secret is a good set of teeth, because sometimes you're like, you know. But actually, dressing is really quite easy, to be honest. Like doing up your shoelaces, you learn how to do it with one hand.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it took time, you know.
Oh yeah, it takes practice. Here's one for you. Now, I only thought of this earlier this morning. Now, I went to the Good Food Show and I bought lots of pots and pans.
Mm.
And you can actually get a clip-on. It's like, go on to the saucepans and they come with the handles that come off easily.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be awesome if you could actually attach that to your hand so you could actually...
Well, actually, in the early days, one of the things that's really funny is that we were looking at things that we could interchange, like gadgets onto my prosthetic, you know. Mm. That functionality, but actually after a while you realise that, you know, that really what you're looking for, it isn't any of that. But at the same time, you know, there's lots of gadgets you can you can have that improve the functionality of how you work, like a pasta machine, get an electric one.
Yeah.
You know, it's easy, but actually when you get electric, it makes it easy for everybody instead of having a two-handed job. So what you realise is technology helps disability, gadgets help disability, but it also help able people too to work more efficiently. So it's nice when you think about how you can think about being, having a disability. So you've got to think a little bit ahead. So like you've got to think, well, I'm approaching that door. How am I going to manage here? And I think, okay, so I'm carrying something. I'll put that down, or I think about the bag I'm going to buy. Make sure I can have a put it, you're always thinking about, so you're thinking ahead and always thinking about your environment and always thinking about solutions, which is actually quite good.
Controversial one for you.
Yes.
And one to say to a person with a disability. I've had this a few times, and people who I've interviewed, celebrities I've interviewed, have had this a few times, and we always get different responses, because sometimes it's a bit touchy, sometimes it's not. Did you do something wrong in a previous life to end up with a disability?
Yeah, well, but if this is how I've ended up in this life, damn, I don't know what I'm going to be like in my next life, because, you know, if that's how it goes, and, you know, I've probably done more bad things since having one arm than I have before. But the answer to that is that karma's a funny thing. I just feel extremely lucky that on that day, the only thing that happened to me was the loss of that arm. Because, to be honest with me, you know, as you know, like you travelled down today, somebody lost their life in a car accident. I fell asleep on the motorway and drove off the motorway, and I could have lost my life. Mm. I nearly did. So I just feel grateful for every day that I've lived since, and I've made the most of it. And actually, that's my mantra, that's my spirit. And that is, you know, what they say, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. I lived with the consequences of that day. Thank God no one else was injured. But at the end of the day, you know, only get one life, let's live it. And
absolutely.
To be honest with you, you know, the path I've been through has been difficult. But at the same time, I probably have a really great life with one arm that a lot of people don't have, with two. So.
You're living in such a beautiful place. You've got a fantastic business.
Yeah. It's hard work, but you go for it.
Absolutely. Yeah. Wonderful. Just to relate to you on that as well. The reason what kept me going is I couldn't sit up for 6 months. I got told I'd never sit up again.
Amazing.
And this is why we're doing Wild Disabled, to raise awareness of disabilities and overcoming the disability.
Yeah,
Is when my wife, the hospital I was in, the ward I was in, was actually next to the brain injury unit. Mm. Once you go past the brain injury unit and you come to me, now I'm obviously sitting up now in a scooter or a wheelchair, depending on what day it is. It's surprising, you know, how well you come out of it than compared to other people. Because whatever you say, whatever you do, there are people worse off than you.
Exactly.
And you've just got to say, we've got to crack on with it, you've just got to get on with it, and you've just got to live your life.
Yeah, exactly. And that's how, I'll never forget going over to America, to Utah, to look at prosthetics and to look at the industry. And then I was meeting quadruplegic, you know, people who had no legs, no arms, people who had lost two legs and had one arm. And I just thought, boy, you know, feeling sorry for myself, and actually these people aren't, they're getting on with their life, so crack on, Michael. It's quite inspirational really when you meet people who are achieving, you know, that's you know, and I lost my arm, I didn't know anybody who'd lost their arm, just war heroes, Nelson, you know, it was before the Gulf War. Now, you know, there's a lot more soldiers that have come back with very, very tough injuries in Afghanistan and you know, the Gulf War, and they're cracking on with life too. It's not easy, mentally, physically, it's not easy. But you can rebuild your life.
Yeah, awesome. Michael Keynes, you're absolutely fantastic. I've got a couple of books that I'm going to give away, which is going to be on social media in a few weeks' time.
Brilliant.
Which you kindly signed. And I just want to say thank you for taking part in Wild Disabled.
Thank you, Simon. It's been a real pleasure. You keep up the great work, because you're an inspiration to everyone too.
Oh, cheers, mate. I'll get an MBE soon as well.
Hopefully.